Hello, and thanks for listening in to another episode of the Tree Travel Podcast with me, Laura Sanders. This week, I'm joined by Helen Coffey, travel editor at The Independent, who was once a frequent flyer and has now gone flight-free for over a year. She's written a book about her adventures and her investigation into the impacts the aviation industry is having on the environment. Throughout the pandemic, build back better has been the buzz phrase as the travel industry had time to reflect during lockdown on its impact on the planet. But travelling more sustainably is easier said than done, especially when flights are often cheaper and more convenient, and most of us are tight on time. But Helen makes it sound totally doable in her book, and during this episode, she reflects on her experience of using trains, bikes, and hitchhiking, among other modes of transport, to go to Croatia, Amsterdam, and even Morocco. I'll also be getting her tips for going flight-free for the first time, so I hope you enjoy it and, like me, become inspired to try train travel on your next trip. If you're enjoying the show, do leave behind a rating and a review. And as always, you can see more from my guests on social media by searching the Tree Travel Podcast. So hi, Helen. Thank you so much for coming on and having a chat to me about your new book, Zero Altitude, and how you've learned to fly less and travel more. But before we get onto that, just tell me a little bit about yourself. You know, what do you do? What were your travels like before you went flight free?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Laura. Lovely to be on the show with you and to chat about travel. So I am currently the travel editor at The Independent. So travel is a big part of my job. I mean, not as big a part as people seem to think, because they're always very excited and they're like, oh my gosh, you get to travel all the time. Now, even before the pandemic, the answer was no. I spent a lot of time at a desk writing stories about people getting drunk on, you know, Ryanair flights. But particularly the last 2 years, it's been a massive challenge, as it has been for all of us. We've seen so many new rules and restrictions crop up that stop us from doing what we love. But yeah, prior to this project, to writing Zero Altitude, I would call myself an extremely frequent flyer. A lot of that was for work, and particularly the year before I gave up, 2019, the first half of that year, I took an insane amount of flights. I mean, the most I've ever taken, I think, before. I just had all these trips lined up and I just was thoughtlessly getting on a plane nearly every weekend, actually. And even when it was for my own holidays, my own kind of leisure travel, it didn't really occur to me to not fly. You know, it's so cheap, it's so easy. I would just be like, bam, off I go to Edinburgh, to Venice, to wherever else. So yes, my habits have changed massively by doing this and taking on this project of going flight free. And it's really opened my eyes to a different way of traveling.
Yeah, you say you weren't traveling that much. I mean, I'm a travel writer as well. You do sit at the desk most of the time, but every weekend it seems like you've got quite a bit of travel in there. Where's the furthest that you've flown? I imagine you've been all over the world, haven't you, with these trips?
Do you know what? Surprisingly, loads of my travel has been short haul, purely because of that fact of you need to be back at a desk. So it's very hard to get away to really long haul destinations unless you're just properly taking it as holiday and you say, okay, I'm going to be out of the office, not on my emails for 2 weeks. So yeah, not as much as you think. Actually, I really surprised my colleagues once, I remember in a conversation, because I revealed I'd never taken a connecting flight and they could not believe it. They were just like, what? I was like, yeah, I've just never.
I can't believe this either. Wow, you've never done a connecting flight and now you've given up, so you never will.
Maybe I never will again. I know. Well, so to answer your original question, I think the furthest I ever went was Singapore and Vietnam. Those are the longest ones I've done. And yeah, I never took that onward journey to kind of hit Australia or something that I know lots of people do.
Oh, amazing. Though I've done Vietnam, but I've not done Singapore, but it's on my list because everybody who's been says it's a fantastic city to visit. So you didn't get a connecting flight there, or did you get a train to those places? Sorry.
No, this was zero altitude days. So this is when I flew. I mean, my goodness, I'd love to get trains to Singapore like they do in, is it Race Across the World, the BBC show, the first series. Just loved it so much. I mean, what a wonderful, you know, way to sell slow travel. And the idea that you're crossing so many different countries to get there and seeing so many different cultures. And actually, you just miss all that when you're just zonked out for 13 hours on a flight. And I've done that flight a couple of times now because a friend of mine used to live there. And I'm not saying it wasn't worth it, but you do spend the first 2 days, or I did anyway, just feeling like an absolute zombie. I do feel like there's something about jet lag that is your body going, what on earth just happened to me? Like, what did you just do? Because you're just flinging yourself across so far.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, whenever I've done a long haul flight, I've always suffered the next couple of days, not just with sleep, but with mouth ulcers, generally feeling run down. So it's not good for you, is it? And I guess the beauty of slow travel, like in Right Across the World, a show I absolutely love, by the way, and cannot wait for it to come back, is that you're slowly adjusting to the time zones, aren't you, as you make your way around? So you don't have that jet lag. And of course, you actually see much more of the world. Brilliant. So let's get on to going flight free then. So this all started with an assignment, didn't it? You started looking into this Scandinavian movement, wasn't it? And at first you describe in your book, they were kind of like nut jobs, and then you ended up being one yourself. So just tell me about that assignment and what inspired you to try this yourself.
Yeah, so I mean, it kind of kicked off in Sweden. They often they often start things, don't they? And it was called the Flygskam movement, which translates as flight shame. And it got mistranslated a lot at the time, actually, as flight shaming. And this idea that people were looking down on you if you took a flight, which is definitely not the vibe. The vibe is you're just looking at your own habits. But anyway, it kept coming up more and more and more. And I thought, oh, I wonder, you know, if we've got some British contingents of that who have decided to commit to going flight free. And actually, very quickly found that, yes, there's a flight free UK movement. So I thought, right, OK, great. I'll write a feature about these people. Because at that time, it seemed like an absolutely outrageous concept, I have to say. The idea that people are just committed to stopping flying. I couldn't believe it. I thought, there must be some weird catch to this. So I looked them up and found Anna Hughes, who's the founder of the Flight Free UK movement here. And so got in touch with her, and she was like, great, we can have a chat. I'll also put you in touch with some other people who have pledged to give up flying. And it's only ever for a year at a time. So the idea is that you sign up to the Flight Free, insert year here, pledge. So this year it's Flight Free 2022. Because it's easier to get people to commit to something, I suppose, medium term. So if it's just for a month, well, that's too easy, isn't it? If it's forever, people are like, that's way too hard, I can't do it. So the logic behind it is, okay, 12 months, you can probably do that, see how you get on. And by the time the 12 months is up, you've changed your habits so significantly that perhaps you keep signing up again and again, and, you know, maybe never take a flight. So yeah, I had this idea that they'd all be a bit wacky and a bit like, I suppose, early kind of veganism, you know, when it was seen as a bit kooky instead of the very cool, trendy thing it is now. But actually, once I phoned up these people and interviewed them, they were all, not only were they all very normal and like, oh, you're just a nice person, they were also very, very non-preachy, non-judgmental. So there was no talking to me and making me feel awful for being a travel editor. There was no kind of, well, how many flights have you taken? Do you know how much carbon dioxide that's put into the atmosphere? Which is, again, I think that's what put me off and that's what I thought it would be like. And in fact, talking to these people, I thought, oh no, they're just really passionate about the planet, as we all should be, all really, really committed to doing whatever they can to try and make things a bit better. And yeah, just I think that's what came across, is like a love and a care for the earth we inhabit, rather than trying to kind of play a game of one-upmanship where you get to feel better than everyone else. So I sort of ended that feature, and it almost planted this little seed in me that I thought, oh, okay, that's interesting. And it just kind of grew and grew and grew over the next 6 months. And I was like, I feel like I should try and do this. I feel like it would say quite a lot for someone working in travel to try and do it and to prove that it's possible. So that's where it began, really.
It's really interesting, because as well,
you know, doing what we do, we come across a lot of different stories. And nowadays, you know, sustainable travel is a real buzzword. And you can almost feel like a hypocrite when you're preaching at people in articles to travel more sustainably and slowly, and then you've not tried it yourself. So yeah, I totally get that, you know, they planted that seed in your head. And it's great that they weren't sort of, as you say, judgmental. I think with that attitude of not being judgmental, not sort of alienating people, it makes you want to try. So yeah, that's really interesting. So you first put it to the test with interrailing, didn't you? You went from London to Paris and then on to Croatia, is that right?
So when did I start? So I started in 2020, and then I think my first trip before interrailing was, I thought I'll try a bit of UK travel. So this was just before the pandemic hit, actually. I took the Caledonian Sleeper up to Inverness. And I'd never taken that train before. And anyone who's taken it will attest to the fact it is just a very magical experience. I've taken it another time since. And there's something about, you set off from, you know, a horrible Euston station. Let's not beat about the bush. It's not the nicest place in the world. But then you have this little bed and a little cabin, and, you know, they give you a sleep mist to put on your pillow. Like, it's all very delightful. And then you wake up and you're literally, you know, you're in the Highlands, and it is, the sun's rising over these kind of beautiful landscapes. And for me, that is just, what an experience. It kind of beats flying every time. The reason people don't do it is because it's more expensive, as we will see with many of these journeys. That's kind of the main reason that people fly, in fact, is price point. But I would say the experience of it is so, so much more enjoyable. And you kind of actually get a jump on people who are flying, because if you set off, for example, you get the train on a Friday night, you finish work as normal, you fall asleep in your little train cabin, and you wake up early in the morning and you're already there. Now, you wouldn't be able to do that if you flew. I mean, you could kind of fit it in, but it would be a lot more stressful, I would argue, than that, where you haven't lost any time because you're traveling while you're asleep. And actually, that's the kind of similar experience I had on my interrailing trip, because I took, obviously, the Eurostar to Paris and then changed the train there to Germany onto Munich, and then got the sleeper train from there all the way to Croatia. And again, you save so much time, because actually, obviously, it's not as fast as jumping on a plane, but I was pretty surprised that I left at kind of 10 a.m. one morning and I was in Rijeka in Croatia at 10 a.m. the next morning. So really, I'd only taken one day traveling to get there, and it felt quite far to reach, you know. So I was actually very pleasantly surprised at how far you can get if you use sleeper services and you kind of time your connections right.
That's really interesting. And the Caledonian Express as well, it's something I keep looking at doing, thinking, oh, shall I try it? Oh, I can't imagine a sleeper train being good in the UK. But you say it is. It sounds magical. It sounds like something off, I don't know, Harry Potter or something. So then, of course, the real first abroad trip was then that one you've just described, to Paris, then on to Croatia. And I read in your book that the Croatians you met couldn't believe you'd got there by train. And they'd said that their train services are so unreliable, they could not believe you were there on time, and they thought you were crazy. Is that a reaction you got a lot from people when you told them what you were going to do?
Yeah, definitely. And I think especially the further you go, the more people just, yeah, you just think it's wild. They're like, what is happening right now? Why are you doing this? I mean, the one where I experienced it most was where I went the furthest. So I got the ferry service to Morocco from France, from Marseille. And that, if you're not kind of driving there, as in the reason you get that ferry is because you've got your car load of stuff, you know, you're taking stuff with you, or you've got your whole family, or there are reasons. And I didn't have a car. I was just a foot passenger. And as it turned out, I was the only foot passenger. And people just, they just couldn't get their heads around it. They were like, but why would you do that? And I also was trying to explain very bad French why. So, I mean, there was a language barrier thing as well. But especially on the way back from Morocco, the guy seemed so suspicious of me at the sort of passport control bit. And again, I was the only passenger, so he might well be suspicious, but he just couldn't He was like, something dodgy must be going on here, because otherwise she wouldn't be doing this. What's she hiding? You know, she's some kind of drugs mule. I suppose I shouldn't have been as surprised as I was. But having never traveled that way before, I hadn't quite got my head around the fact that a lot of people would just be really, really flabbergasted by it and would never have come across someone traveling that way, I suppose.
That's funny, a drugs mule. I'm sure they probably did think that if you were the only foot passenger. And traveling solo as a woman as well, I mean, there's always that fear of feeling safe on trains, particularly if you're going to sleep on one and you're on your own, you've kind of not got anybody watching your back. Did you ever feel unsafe or wary at any point?
That's a really good question, actually. Not really, especially not on the transport ever. I think in general, I am someone that doesn't really perceive a lot of risk. I don't know if that's the way of summing up, but you know, some people are kind of looking for threats everywhere. I am very oblivious and I'm aware of that in myself. So other people perhaps might have felt a bit more intimidated, but I've also done a lot of solo travel as a woman, so I think it's something I'm very used to. I think the closest I came really was just, you know, I'm sure you will know this, Laura, and listeners might know this as well, that, you know, in Morocco, as a white woman without a man in sight, you do get a lot of catcalling. You know, it's kind of constant, and at first I found that a bit overwhelming, even though I've been prepared for it, but I did kind of get used to it, and also just got used to the fact it's almost like I just like a knee-jerk response, I think, to just seeing, oh, woman, why, okay, I'll just shout some stuff at her. And actually the longer it went on, I was like, oh, I don't think there's any kind of actual implicit threat behind this. I think it's just, oh, that's what, oh, darling, you want a boyfriend. I never actually thought, oh, well, this man's gonna follow me home and hurt me or anything, like, not at all. So I think it's just getting used to cultural difference as well. But what I will say is I did get quite good at, especially on that trip, if you are going to travel alone, and I think not even just as a woman but just as a human, I think it's really good to just send someone, or maybe a couple of people. So I send it to my sister and my friend, a kind of full itinerary. Okay, this is where you're going to be on what dates. These are the trains you're taking. These are the hotels you're staying at. This is the number of the hotel. If they don't hear from you for a day or two, they start making those calls. Because actually, you know, it's a big world. There are risks everywhere. I don't think we should stop living our lives, but it's good to just have something in place, because I thought otherwise no one knows where I am or where I'm going, like no one. And especially when you haven't got flights to catch, you haven't quite got that same, oh, well, we'll know if she doesn't get on that flight, because trains are a bit like, oh, well, I could get the next one. You know, I'm not tied in the same way. So I think you can still take steps to make yourself feel that bit safer.
Yeah, that's really sound advice, Helen. I've actually done that myself in the past, traveling solo, and just as well, sending all of my travel documents, like insurance and things, just in case I lose it. I've got someone back home who can send it across. It gives people back home that bit of reassurance as well, doesn't it? I mean, I have two worrying parents at home who haven't done all the stuff that I've done. So, I think it reassures them as well. So that's really sound advice. What's been your favourite train journey then, and why? In this experiment, in what you've done, what's been the favourite one and why?
I think probably just because it was my first time out of the country since, you know, the pandemic and since lockdowns and everything. I think taking that the Nightjet sleeper train from Munich to Rijeka, I found just really, really amazing experience. I actually didn't have a berth, like a cabin, on that train, because it was a really weird time for booking travel, and the kind of the Interrail pass people were like, oh, sorry, we couldn't book you one. They were all taken, and as it turned out, they definitely weren't, because it was a really empty train. But they just, at that time of being so weirdly cautious, I think the capacity rules meant they wouldn't sell all the carriages anyway, so I ended up sort of on this row of seats. And it was a bit Harry Potter, actually, because it's those European train cabins where you sort of open the doors at the side and there are three chairs facing three chairs. I think it's very kind of old worldy to me. And there was just one other guy in this cabin, and we sort of nodded at each other and we tried to sort of have a conversation, but didn't have any shared languages at all. So that kind of just stopped. And then I don't know, it was just quite exciting to kind of, I was like, right, I'm going to bed down on my three seats of the night. I like fully got into my pajamas. I took off my makeup. This man was looking at me like I was insane, because no one really does that when you're not sleeping in a cabin. But I was like, you know what? It's nighttime. I've got a process. I've got a ritual. And it was, yeah, it was kind of odd as well, because I just think I would have presumed you'd then, that would be it for the night. But you are crossing over several countries, because you're going Germany, Austria, Slovenia, Croatia. And so like every time you kind of crossed into another country, the guards seemed to wanted to see your ticket again. And I was like, surely there's a better way to do this, because I did actually fall asleep, but like every kind of few hours I'd get woken up again by sort of guard shouting at me, and I was like, oh god, whoa, where am I? The worst one being Croatia, because it's not in Schengen, so they have to physically come on and check your passport, which I had forgotten would happen. And they also are a bit more intense when they're the passport ones, because I think they might have had guns, or they did in my mind. I was half asleep. Anyway, I was just a bit like awoken by a gruff man, possibly with a gun, demanding to see my passport. And I was like, oh my gosh, what's happening? I'm making this sound not very fun, but it felt very adventurous for me, I think, because it was my first time doing that sort of thing, coupled with first time traveling during pandemic all together. I was like, this feels like real travel. Do you know what I mean? Not just like, oh, I've got a jet 2 flight to Benidorm. Not that there's, I'm not judging that. It's just, it is a very different experience.
Absolutely. And it's a sort of a moment in time that you'll never get back again, for, you know, A, the reason that it was the pandemic and not a lot of people could travel, and B, your first time interrailing, your first time doing anything, it's always unique, isn't it? So I could totally understand why that was your most memorable train journey so far. And funnily enough, I've had guns pointed at me on a train by the SWAT team in Thailand, who had a tip about some drug dealers being on the train, and they'd gotten the right seat numbers but the wrong carriage. So they came up plain clothed and just pulled the curtains open to the boys next to us and pointed guns at their heads, and then realised that there were a couple of white British boys on holiday, and they indeed weren't drug dealers. And then they ran down the train and caught the drug dealers. So that's my crazy train story. And funnily enough,
wow,
cut me off. I would do it again.
That is a lot intense, I have to say.
Yeah, so we're really selling it, aren't we? But I would do it again. I know it's just a one-off, and you have these funny stories to tell after, so there you go, there you have it. So the reason obviously we're talking about going flight free and all of these crazy train journeys is of course because flying produces a heck of a lot of carbon emissions. So just for the listeners who don't quite know what this is, could you just quickly define what carbon offsetting is? Because we're hearing it more and more now with flights. You have this chance to carbon offset, or your airline will do it for you. And I think it's something that people are interested in. You know, they want to ease their guilt. But yeah, just because you've written about that in your book as well, just tell me a little bit about that.
The basic idea behind it originally was, and it wasn't for individuals, it was for kind of whole countries. They get set, you've got to cut your carbon emissions by X amount, by X percent. So all your industries across the board have to try and do that. And some industries would find it quite easy because they weren't emitting that much in the first place, or they could just very simply switch from one way of doing things to another, and they'd say, great, we've made this saving. And for some companies, they might be like, well, we got asked to save 10% and we actually saved 20%. And then a market grew up where they could sell the extra 10% they didn't need to cut, but they had cut, to a company that was finding it really hard. So you can see there's a kind of lot, there's a logic to it, but it can equally get out of hand quite quickly, because you also, unrelated to that, then kind of schemes grew up where projects would say, right, well, we're going to save a certain amount of emissions, and then we can sell that again to a company that's finding it hard to cut down. And it's the same in the individual offsetting market. You're buying some savings, in inverted commas. But it's quite murky because it really depends on what the project is. So you've got this idea that carbon has been removed somehow from the atmosphere in that process. And sometimes it has, if it's a particular scheme that removes emissions, like, for example, the one we hear about all the time is growing trees, because they you know, breathe in the carbon. So what you're doing is you're kind of buying that saving. But a lot of the schemes don't work that way. They work because they've swapped one kind of energy for another. So something that was using fossil fuels will now use renewable energy. So then it gets harder to calculate, because you're like, well, no carbon's been taken away. You're saying in future, this activity will emit less carbon. So sorry, I mean, that's a very meandering way of saying it is complicated. It's not to say that you should never offset your flights. What it is to say is that you need to do a bit of research before you do that, before you buy a carbon credit, which is what they call them. It's a ton of carbon saving. If it's a real proper legit one, it's probably going to be quite pricey, as in it's going to cost you maybe 20 quid a ton. I think that's what I've said in the book. One of the scientists said, gave me a ballpark figure. So essentially, if an airline's like, oh, we'll round it up by £2 and you've offset your flight, absolutely, that is not what's happening. They'll have schemes that they're giving money to, but that is not going to offset your flight. As with much of the sustainability world, what we always say is, you know, you reduce first and then offset with anything you can't get away with. So when it comes to travel, you really think about what flights you need to take, and the ones you definitely have to take, you then offset using a scheme you think is reputable because you've done some good sort of research on it.
It is, as you say, mind-boggling, isn't it? And, you know, for a consumer who just wants to book their flight and to feel a little bit better about it, it's not there yet, is it? And as you say, it's better to not use that energy in the first place than to try and offset it. It's really interesting. So you've not only tried catching trains to not fly, you've also tried hitchhiking and cycling and other methods of non-flying. So just tell me a bit about those and how they felt. I mean, I don't know, I'd be really scared to try hitchhiking, but I know people who've done it and who've loved it and who've been returned home safely. So yeah, tell us about it.
I really enjoyed my little mini hitchhiking experience. I can't claim to be any kind of hitchhiking expert, because I felt the same as you, Laura. I felt very nervous. I think it's our generation, and especially when you're a woman, you've almost been I don't want to say brainwashed, but you've been taught it's not safe, it's not safe, it's not safe. That is not really backed up by any data. I mean, as with many of the things we're afraid of, if you were to look at kind of into research about it, there's no statistical thing that says you're more likely to be harmed, abducted, whatever else when hitchhiking, either as someone picking up a passenger or being the passenger. But, you know, we have lots of cultural references that teach us, you know, this is the way you get murdered by an axe wielding nut job on the road, so don't do it. So anyway, I was a bit of a wuss. So I took Simon Calder, who is our travel correspondent at The Independent, very well known. And also, if you do know him, you'll know he absolutely loves hitchhiking. It's one of his favourite things. One reason is because he loves not spending money, and he would be very open about that. But the other is that he just loves the sort of adventurousness of it. The fact you meet someone on the road that you wouldn't meet otherwise, and you kind of exchange stories. So he kind of took me under his wing. I needed to get to Oxford, really not very far away from London, but I was like, for a first jaunt, let's stick quite close to home. So he kind of told me where to turn up. He said, meet me at Hanger Lane station and, you know, we'll get going. And one of the reasons I needed help, actually, and I don't know if anyone will identify with this, is that I don't drive, and therefore I don't know any of the roads. You know, that kind of base knowledge that lots of people seem to have of like, oh, the M, whatever goes here. It's just not there for me. It doesn't exist because I've never had to drive anywhere. So I'm like, I wouldn't have the faintest idea like what road to stand on to get to Oxford. You know what I mean? So it was very good having his help. I just found it quite moving because I think I had in my head, like, no one will stop. Why would anyone stop and pick us up? That's mad. That is mad. And then I think within 15 minutes, this lovely chap had pulled in for us. He was like, oh, just get in. Yeah, it's on my way. You know, we had a really, really nice chat, kind of swapped all our best anecdotes as we went. And I finished it feeling kind of this wonderful, like, I don't know, one with the universe. I thought, people are nice. People are nice. And we forget it because especially if you live in a big city, you can get into this place where you don't trust anyone. You know, you think everyone's out to get you a bit. And actually that restores your faith in humanity, that people just do things because it's a lovely thing to do and not everything has to be paid for. I think that's another thing I get in my mind, is that there's always a price though. Like, what, you know, when's it coming? And that is one example where there's not, you don't, that's it. You've had a nice time together. He's had a chat with someone instead of having to, you know, listen to his own thoughts. It's a wonderful exchange, I would say. So I would recommend it. I would, if you're going for your first time, say, if you've got a friend who's done it before, maybe hook up with them just so you feel a bit of reassurance. But I definitely will be trying it again.
That's good. I'm glad you had such a positive experience and you took an expert with you. That's good. So what was the person like that picked you up? What was he travelling for? Was it work, family? And did you tell him that you were both journalists at The Independent? Do you think that sort of, you know, affected it at all? Or
so he was going home to see his family. He was kind of mid-20s, so quite young. Because at first I thought, oh, I wonder if it's someone that's recognised Simon, because he is often on the BBC. But no, he had no idea. He just thought it was some old geezer. And I'm talking about me, of course, not Simon. I think we only sort of revealed that, you know, maybe 10 to 15 minutes in when we were chatting. And I sort of said, I'm writing a book actually about trying to travel without flying. And it turned out he's quite passionate about the environment as well. So we had a really nice talk about that, you know, just very serendipitous.
Oh, lovely. How humbling. You know, you get picked up and hitchhiking and talk about the environment together. It's all very, very lovely. I'm glad. And you've tried cycling as well. And of course, the perfect place to do that is Amsterdam. I've been there myself. And actually, that was a flight-free trip. I got the DP, is it the DF? DDP, the ferry anyway from Newcastle. That was an experience. It wasn't the most glamorous of ferries, but there you go. Anyway, we got the ferry there, 12 hours overnight. Didn't get to cycle though, but that's, you know, you went there and you tried cycling and you actually managed to get sort of out of the thick of it, didn't you? Once you cycled out a little bit, it was like a completely different place.
Yeah, I love Amsterdam for that. It's one of the cities I've been to most, but I realized on this kind of recent trip, just didn't really know it at all, other than the very kind of small area that tourists always stick to, which was within the canal ring, which is lovely because that's where all the pretty gabled buildings are. And obviously you want to see some of that. But you realise within 10 minutes on a bike, you're just like, oh, I don't know where I am. Amazing. And it's just got such a wonderful cycling infrastructure. And in fact, I would say, if you don't really cycle often or you'd be too scared to do it in the UK, please try it somewhere like the Netherlands, because their whole infrastructure is so different and so safe. You're never really cycling on the road. That just doesn't happen because there's separate paths everywhere you go. And in fact, the busier the roads are, the more separated you are. So in fact, you know, sometimes here I cycle in London, I commute by bike, and most of the time I feel okay, but I also know if I get lost, I might end up somewhere absolutely terrifying. I might end up on a giant roundabout and just freak out and have to just take my bike off the road and figure out what to do. Whereas that, you just can't really do that in Amsterdam. It's not possible because you're on the side on your lovely little bike path, cycling along, having a lovely time. So it was really eye-opening for that and just to see different parts. So I kind of cycled along the Amstel River and then went to see, I mean, my pronunciation will be terrible, I apologise, but the Zuidoost area, which is like completely different to quaint Amsterdam. It is kind of very urban, very multicultural, very, you know, built up, very colourful, kind of cool. Yeah, it was really nice to see that because I've never experienced that part of the city before. And it just made me feel like I was falling in love with it all over again in a new way because I got to see different sides of it.
That's great. You know, I'd love to see some more of Amsterdam and Holland. In fact, you know, obviously I stuck to the touristy bit in the middle, but no, it's a lovely place, really lovely. And yeah, very much geared up for cycling. I think we could learn a trick or two from there, couldn't we? And do you know what? I live in a village and to get anywhere, there is a motorway either side of my village. So I'm like pens in. So it really puts me off cycling because I just feel like I'm going to get mowed over. But I so wish they would put more cycle lanes in this country. You know, if you want people to travel sustainably, give them the path to do it. But there you go. That's another debate, another argument, isn't it? Let's not get started on that. Obviously, there's so much more in your book, plenty of advice as well. And you know, it's really witty. It's really funny. And it makes me feel as though I can go off and try this now and get a train somewhere and not fly. And just on that, actually, you know, for any sort of first timer, anybody thinking about going abroad, so let's say Europe for the first time on a train, what are your top tips?
So, I mean, my first one, I should basically be his PR at this point because I bring him up all the time. But if you haven't heard of the man in seat 61, that's the first tip everyone gave to me when I said I was doing this. It's a guy called Mark Smith set it up, who used to be manager at British Rail and is just train mad, knows everything about trains. And he set it up as a kind of side project and now it's his whole business. So he essentially tells you how to get to any two places by train, really. And you need someone breaking it down because otherwise it's incredibly complicated just because of the way that the infrastructure is not there in the same way it is for booking flights with trains throughout Europe. You know, some of them you have to go direct to one website. Some of them you can book together all through the train line, but they're not going to be through tickets. They're all separate tickets. And he just really, really, you know, simply sets out, these are the different ways you can do it. You can travel over 2 days, you can travel over 3 days, you can stop here. If you want to spend that night here, here's a hotel recommendation. Like, it's lovely. It's got like all the different bits you would want. He sometimes puts in restaurant recommendations at stations. Like, you know, he's done it all and he knows. So I'd say, first off, go onto that website and look it up because that will tell you how to book it in the best possible way, including things like, oh, this website is all in Spanish. You need to know that this means a cabin, like a berth, otherwise you won't get a bed. So that is probably the best tip I could give. After that, I would say, and I didn't do this very well, so I didn't practice what I'm preaching now, but I would if I could do it again. So prioritize journeys as much as you do destinations, because you're going to be spending a lot of time traveling. So look up, like, what are the most beautiful train journeys I can do? And actually try and like use that as one of your key factors in deciding where to go. Don't try and rush that bit. Don't try and get somewhere as quickly as you can, unless you are kind of competitively minded or you have very, very little annual leave. I would say, really take your time. So if you're going like somewhere in Central or Eastern Europe, plan out, where am I going to stop along the way for a few days? You know, in much the same way as you would do, you know, if you're on a cruise ship, they're not just going to take you straight to, you know, the furthest port, are they? Every few days they're going to stop somewhere where so you can enjoy it. So try and build that into your train travel as well, I would say, so that you have this really interesting multi-destination trip that you can come home and you tell people about and they're like, oh my gosh, wow, that sounds amazing. So yeah, I think really putting all that together, it's like the journey, you know, the horrible cliche, you know, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. But it is true when you're doing safe travel, that has to be baked into what you're doing, otherwise you will not enjoy it.
Some really good tips there, and actually I'm going to go to that website myself and have a look, and never know, next time I speak to you I might have tried a train journey to Europe, who knows? That's fantastic. Hopefully, you know, over the next few years, I think we are all emerging from this pandemic slightly different people, aren't we? We want travel to build back better, as cliche as that sounds, we do. And it's just giving people these ideas and these avenues to do that. All I would say is probably one of the biggest obstacles, and you mentioned it there yourself, is most people are very limited with annual leave, aren't they? And I guess the pull of flying is that you can be in Spain in 2 hours and have your most of the time on the beach. But as you say, make it part of the adventure. Choose those interesting rail routes. I mean, I've seen some fantastic train journeys through Montenegro, through the Balkans, and oh, that's on my bucket list. So yeah, some really sound advice there. It's been really interesting speaking to you, Helen. Thank you so much for coming on. And you've definitely inspired me to try doing some more train travel now. Have you got any other adventures lined up in the next few months?
Nothing is set in stone at the moment, but I really want to try kind of new sleeper trains and new ferry services. So I'm particularly keen to do, there's a new overnight train from Paris to Vienna. I'm pretty sure you could set off on Friday late afternoon, go to Paris, get the sleeper, wake up in Vienna on Saturday morning, which I just think is so cool. So I'm really hoping to try that.
Oh, amazing. Well, I look forward to seeing how that goes if you do that. Thank you, Helen. And your book comes out in May.
Yes, 26th of May.
Lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.